passed. Albertus regularly reported everything to Adrede. Each new report worried her more. Even the obvious subservience of Albertus bothered her. "Of course, the councillors do not mean public support," Albertus said. She could only agree. The behaviour of the councillors signalled that they had powerful backing among the middle echelons of the priesthood, among the climbers who dared joke about their divided god at weekend parties, among those being soothed by the hoard Adrede had found at Siege Tabor. 90,000 long tons. Half a year's harvest from the deserts of Rakis. Even a third of it represented a significant bargaining chip in the new balances. "I wish I had never met you, Albertus." She had wanted to restore in him the one who cares. What she had actually done was easily recognized by one trained in the Missionaria Protectiva's ways, a grovelling sycophant. It made no difference now that his subservience was driven by an absolute belief in her holy association with Shiana. Adrede had never before focused on how easily the Missionaria Protectiva's teachings destroyed human independence. That was always the goal, of course. Make them followers, obedient to our needs. The tyrant's words in that secret chamber had done more than ignite her fears for the sisterhood's future. "I bequeath to you my fear and loneliness." From that millennial distance, he had planted doubts in her as surely as she had planted them in Waf. She saw the tyrant's questions as though they had been limned with glowing light on her inner eye. "With whom do you ally? Are we no more than a secret society? How will we meet our end? In a dogmatic stink of our own creation?" The tyrant's words had been burned into her consciousness. Where was the noble purpose in what the sisterhood did? Adrede could almost hear Taraz's sneering response to such a question. "Survival, Dar. That's all the noble purpose we need. Survival. Even the tyrant knew that." Perhaps even Tuuk had known it. And what had that brought him in the end? Adrede felt a haunting sympathy for the late High Priest. Tuuk had been a superb example of what a tightly knit family could produce. Even his name was a clue, unchanged from Atreides' days on this planet. The founding ancestor had been a smuggler, confident of the first Leto. Tuuk had come from a family that held firmly to its roots, saying, "There is something worth preserving in our past." The example this set for descendants was not lost on a reverend mother. "But you failed, Tuuk." These blocks of modernization visible out her window were a sign of that failure. Sops to the rising power elements in Rakian society, those elements that the sisterhood had worked so long to foster and strengthen. Tuuk had seen this as a harbinger of the day when he would be too weak politically to prevent the things implied by such modernization. A shorter and more upbeat ritual. New songs, more in the modern manner. Changes in the dancing. Traditional dances take so long. Above all, fewer ventures into the dangerous desert for the young postulants from the powerful families. Adrede sighed and glanced back at Waf. The little Tlelaxu chewed his lower lip. "Good. Damn you, Albertus, I would welcome your rebellion." Behind the closed doors of the temple, the transition of the high priesthood already was being debated. The new Rakians spoke of the need to keep up with the times. They meant, give us more power. "It has always been this way," Adrede thought, "even in the Bene Gesserit." Still, she could not escape the thought, poor Tuuk. Albertus reported that Tuuk, just before his death and replacement by the face dancer, had warned his kin they might not retain family control of the high priesthood when he died. Tuuk had been more subtle and resourceful than his enemies expected. His family already was calling in its debts, gathering its resources to retain a power base. And the face dancer in Tuuk's place revealed much by his mimic performance. The Tuuk family had not yet learned of the substitution, and one might almost believe the original high priest had not been replaced, so good was this face dancer. Observing that face dancer in action betrayed much to the watchful reverend mothers. That, of course, was one of the things that had Waf squirming now. Adrede turned abruptly on one heel and strode across to the Tlelaxu master. Time to have at him. She stopped 2 paces from Woff and glared down at him. Woff met her gaze with defiance.
"You've had enough time to consider your position," she accused. "Why do you remain silent?"
"My position? You think you give us a choice?"
"Man is but a pebble dropped in a pool," she quoted at him from his own beliefs.
Woff took a trembling breath. She spoke the proper words, but what lay behind such words? They no longer sounded right, coming from the mouth of a Pawinda woman. When Woff did not respond, O'Draid continued her quotation.
"And if man is but a pebble, then all his works can be no more."
An involuntary shudder swept through O'Draid, causing a look of carefully masked surprise in the watchful guardian sisters. That shudder was not part of the required performance.
"Why do I think of the tyrant's words at this moment?" O'Draid wondered.
"The body and soul of the Bene Gesserit will meet the same fate as all other bodies and all other souls."
His barb had gone deep into her.
"How was I made so vulnerable?"
The answer leaped into her awareness.
"The Atreides Manifesto. Composing those words under Taraza's watchful guidance opened a flaw within me."
Could that have been Taraza's purpose? To make O'Draid vulnerable? How could Taraza have known what would be found here on Rakkis? The Mother Superior not only displayed no prescient abilities, she tended to avoid this talent in others. On the rare occasions when Taraza had demanded such a performance of O'Draid herself, the reluctance had been obvious to the trained eye of a sister.
"Yet she made me vulnerable."
Had it been an accident? O'Draid sank into a swift recital of the litany against fear. Only a few eye blinks, but in that time Woff visibly came to a decision.
"You would force it upon us," he said, "but you do not know what powers we have reserved for such a moment."
He lifted his sleeves to show where the dart throwers had been.
"These were but paltry toys by comparison with our real weapons."
"The Sisterhood has never doubted this," O'Draid said.
"Is it to be violent conflict between us?" he asked.
"It is your choice to make," she said.
"Why do you court violence?"
"There are those who would love to see Bene Gesserit and Bene Tlelax at each other's throats," O'Draid said. "Our enemies would enjoy stepping in to pick up the pieces after we had weakened ourselves sufficiently."
"You state the argument for agreement, but you give my people no room to negotiate. Perhaps your Mother Superior gave you no authority to negotiate."
How tempting it was to pass it all back into Taraza's hands, just as Taraza wanted. O'Draid glanced at the Guardian sisters. The two faces were masks, betraying nothing. What did they really know? Would they realize if she went against Taraza's orders?
"Do you have such authority?"
Woff persisted.
"Noble purpose," O'Draid thought. "Surely the tyrant's golden path demonstrated at least one quality of such purpose."
O'Draid decided on a creative truth. "I have such authority," she said. Her own words made it true. Having taken the authority, she made it impossible for Taraza to deny it. O'Draid knew, though, that her own words committed her to a course sharply divergent from the sequential steps of Taraza's design.
Independent action.
The very thing she had desired of Albertus.
"But I am on the scene and know what is needed."
O'Draid glanced at the Guardian sisters.
"Remain here, please, and see that we are not disturbed."
To Woff, she said,
"We might as well be comfortable."
She indicated 2 chair dogs set at right angles to each other across the room. O'Draid waited until they were seated before resuming the conversation.
"We require a degree of candor between us that diplomacy seldom allows. Too much hangs in the balance for us to engage in shallow evasions."
Woff looked at her strangely. He said,
"We know there is dissension in your highest councils. Subtle overtures have been made to us. Is this part of—"
"I am loyal to the Sisterhood," she said. "Even those who approached you had no other loyalty."
"Is this another trick of—"
"No tricks."
"With the Bene Gesserit, there are always tricks,"
he accused.
"What is it you fear from us? Name it."
"Perhaps I have learned too much from you for you to allow me to go on living."
"Could I not say the same of you?" she asked. Who else knows of our secret affinity? This is no Pawinda female talking to you here.
She adventured the word with some trepidation, but the effect could not have been more revealing. Woff was visibly shaken. He was a long minute recovering. Doubts remained, though, because she had planted them in him.
What do words prove? He asked. You might still take the things you have learned from me and leave my people nothing. You still hold the whip over us.
I carry no weapons in my sleeves, Odraid said.
But in your mind is knowledge that could ruin us.
He glanced back at the Guardian sisters.
They are part of my arsenal, Odraid agreed. Shall I send them away?
And in their minds everything they have heard here, he said.
He returned his wary gaze to Odraid.
Better if you all sent your memories away.
Odraid pitched her voice in its most reasonable tones.
What would we gain by exposing your missionary zeal before you are ready to move? Would it serve us to blacken your reputation by revealing where you have placed your new face dancers? Oh yes, we know about Ix and the fish speakers. Once we had studied your new ones, we went searching for them.
You see?
His voice was dangerously edged.
I see no other way to prove our affinity than to reveal something equally damaging about ourselves, Odraid said.
Woff was speechless.
We would plant the worms of the Prophet on uncounted planets of the scattering, she said. What would the Rakian priesthood say and do if you revealed that?
The Guardian sisters looked at her with thinly masked amusement. They thought she was lying.
I have no guards with me, Woff said. When only one person knows a dangerous thing, how easy it is to gain that person's eternal silence.
She lifted her empty sleeves. He looked at the Guardian sisters.
Very well, Odraid said.
She glanced at the sisters and gave a subtle hand sign to reassure them.
Wait outside, please, sisters.
When the door closed behind them, Woff returned to his doubts.
My people have not searched these rooms. What do I know of the things that could be hidden here to record our words?
Odraid shifted into the language of the Islamiyat.
Then perhaps we should speak another tongue, one known only to us.
Woff's eyes glittered. In the same tongue, he said,
Very well, I will gamble on it. And I ask you to tell me the real cause of dissension among the Bene Gesserit.
Odraid allowed herself a smile. With the change of language, Woff's entire personality, his whole manner, changed. He was performing exactly as expected. None of his doubts had been reinforced in this tongue. She responded with an equal confidence.
Fools fear that we may bring back another Kwisatz Haderach. That is what a few of my sisters argue.
There is no more need of such a one, Woff said. The one who could be many places simultaneously has been and he has gone. He came only to bring the Prophet.
God would not send such a message twice, she said.
It was the very sort of thing Woff had heard often in this tongue. He no longer thought it strange that a woman could utter such words. The language and the familiar words were enough.
Has Shuang Yu's death restored unity among your sisters?
He asked.
We have a common enemy, Odraid said.
The honored Matres.
You were wise to kill them and learn from them.
Woff leaned forward, completely caught up in his familiar tongue and the flow of their conversation.
They rule with sex, he exulted. Remarkable techniques of orgasmic amplification. We,
belatedly he became aware of who was sitting in front of him, hearing all of this.
We already know such techniques, Odraid reassured him. It will be interesting to compare, but there are obvious reasons why we have never tried to ride to power on such a dangerous conveyance. Those whores are just stupid enough to make that mistake.
Mistake?
He was clearly puzzled.
They are holding the reins in their own hands, she said. As the power grows, their control of it must grow. The thing will shatter of its own momentum.
Power? Always power?
Woff muttered. Another thought struck him.
Are you saying this was how the Prophet fell?
He knew what he was doing, she said. Millennia of enforced peace followed by the famine times and the scattering, a message of direct results. Remember, he did not destroy the Bene Tlelax or the Bene Gesserit.
"For what do you hope from an alliance between our two peoples?"
Waff asked. "Hope is one thing, survival another," she said.
"Always pragmatism," Waff said. "And some among you fear that you may restore the Prophet on Rakis with all of his powers intact?"
"Did I not say it?"
The language of the Islamiyat was particularly potent in this questioning form. It placed the burden of proof on Waff.
"So they doubt God's hand in the creation of your Kwisatz Haderach," he said. "Do they also doubt the Prophet?"
"Very well, let us have it all out in the open," Odraid said, and launched herself on the chosen course of deception. Shuang Yu and those who supported her broke away from the great belief. "We harbour no anger toward any Bene Tlelax for having killed them. They saved us the trouble."
Waff accepted this utterly. Given the circumstances, it was precisely what could be expected. He knew he had revealed much here that might better have been held in reserve, but there were still things the Bene Gesserit did not know. And the things he had learned. Odraid shocked him totally then by saying,
"Waff, if you think your descendants from the scattering have returned to you unchanged, then foolishness has become your way of life."
He held himself silent.
"You have all of the pieces in your hands," she said. "Your descendants belong to the whores of the scattering, and if you think any of them will abide by an agreement, then your stupidity goes beyond description."
Waff's reactions told her she had him. The pieces were clicking into place. She had told him truth where it was required. His doubts were refocused where they belonged, against the people of the scattering, and it had been done in his own tongue. He tried to speak past a constriction in his throat and was forced to massage his throat before speech returned.
"What can we do?"
"It's obvious. The Lost Ones have their eyes on us as just one more conquest. They think of it as cleaning up behind them, common prudence."
"But they are so many."
"Unless we unite in a common plan to defeat them, they will chew us up the way a slig chews up its dinner."
"We cannot submit to Pawinda filth. God will not permit it."
"Submit? Who suggests that we submit?"
"But the Bene Gesserit always use that ancient excuse. If you can't beat them, join them."
Odraid smiled grimly.
"God will not permit you to submit. Do you suggest he would permit it of us?"
"Then what is your plan? What would you do against such numbers?"
"Exactly what you plan to do. Convert them. When you say the word, the sisterhood will openly espouse the true faith."
Waff sat in stunned silence. So she knew the heart of the Tlelaxu plan. Did she know also how the Tlelaxu would enforce it? Odraid stared at him, openly speculative.
"Grasp the beast by the balls if you must," she thought.
But what if the projection by the sisterhood's analysts was wrong? This whole negotiation would be a joke in that case. And there was that look in the back of Waff's eyes, that suggestion of older wisdom, much older than his flesh. She spoke with more confidence than she felt.
"What you have achieved with Golas from your tanks, and kept secretly for yourselves alone, others will pay a great price to achieve."
Her words were sufficiently cryptic.
Were others listening?
But Waff did not doubt for an instant that the Bene Gesserit knew even this thing.
"Will you demand a share in that as well?" he asked.
The words rasped in his dry throat.
"Everything. We will share everything."
"What will you bring to this great sharing?"
"Ask."
"All of your breeding records?"
"They are yours."
"Breeding mothers of our choice?"
"Name them."
Waff gasped. This was far more than the Mother Superior had offered. It was like a blossom opening in his awareness. She was right about the Honored Matres, naturally, and about the Tlelaxu descendants from the scattering. He had never completely trusted them, never.
"You will want an unrestricted source of melange, of course," he said.
"Of course."
He stared at her, hardly believing the extent of his good fortune. The axolotl tanks would offer immortality only to those who espoused the great faith. No one would dare attack and attempt to seize a thing they knew that Tlelaxu would destroy rather than lose. And now,
He had gained the services of the most powerful and enduring missionary force known. Surely the hand of God was visible here. Woff was first awed and then inspired. He spoke softly to Adraid.
And you, Reverend Mother, how do you name our accord?
Noble purpose, she said. You already know the prophet's words from Siech Tabor. Do you doubt him?
Never, but there is one thing. What do you propose with that Gola of Duncan, Idaho, and the girl Shiana?
We will breed them, of course, and their descendants will speak for us to all of those descendants of the prophet.
On all of those planets where you would take them?
On all of those planets, she agreed.
Woff sat back.
I have you, Reverend Mother, he thought. We will rule this alliance, not you. The Gola is not yours. He is ours.
Adraid saw the shadow of his reservations in Woff's eyes, but knew she had ventured as much as she dared. More would reawaken doubts. Whatever happened, she had committed the sisterhood to this course. Theraza could not escape this alliance now. Woff squared his shoulders, a curiously juvenile gesture, belied by the ancient intelligence peering from his eyes.
Ah, one thing more, he said,
every bit the master of masters, speaking his own language and commanding all of those who heard him.
Will you also help spread this Atreides manifesto?
Why not? I wrote it.
Woff jerked forward.
You?
Did you think someone of lesser abilities could have done it?
He nodded, convinced without further argument. This was fuel for a thought that had entered his own mind, a final point in their alliance. The powerful minds of Reverend Mothers would advise the Tlelaxu at every turn. What did it matter that they were outnumbered by those whores of the scattering? Who could match such combined wisdom and insurmountable weapons?
The title of the manifesto is valid, too, Adraid said. I am a true descendant of the Atreides.
Would you be one of our breeders?
He ventured.
I am almost past the age of breeding, but I am yours to command.
I remember friends from wars all but we forgot, all of them distilled into each wound we caught. Those wounds are all the painful places where we fought, battles better left behind, ones we never sought. What is it that we spent? And what was it we bought? Songs of the Scattering. Busmali based his planning on the best of what he had learned from his Basha, keeping his own counsel about multiple options and fallback positions. That was a commander's prerogative. Necessarily, he learned everything he could about the terrain. In the time of the old empire, and even under the reign of Muad'Dib, the region around the Gamu Keep had been a forest reserve. High ground rising well above the oily residue that tended to cover Harkonnen land. On this ground, the Harkonnens had grown some of the finest pilingitam, a wood of steady currency, always valued by the supremely rich. From the most ancient times, the knowledgeable had preferred to surround themselves with fine woods rather than with the mass-produced artificial materials known then as polastine, polaz, and pormabat, latterly teen, laz, and bat. As far back as the old empire, there had been a pejorative label for the small, rich, and families minor, arising from the knowledge of a rare wood's value. He's a 3PO, they said, meaning that such a person surrounded himself with cheap copies made from de classe substances. Even when the supremely rich were forced to employ one of the distressful 3POs, they disguised it, where possible, behind OP, the only P, Pilingitam. Busmali knew all of this, and more, as he set his people to searching for a strategically situated pilingitam near the No-Globe. The wood of the tree had many qualities that endeared it to master artisans. Newly cut, it worked like a soft wood. Dried and aged, it endured as a hard wood. It absorbed many pigments, and the finish could be made to appear as though it occurred naturally within the grain. More important, pilingitam was antifungal, and no known insect had ever considered it a suitable dinner. Lastly, it was fire-resistant, and aged specimens of the living tree grew outward from an enlarged and empty tube at the core.
We will do the unexpected,
Vasmali told his searchers. He had noted the distinctive lime green of Palingatam leaves during his first overflight of the region. The forests of this planet had been raided and otherwise logged off during the famine times, but venerable OPs were still nurtured among the evergreens and hardwoods replanted at the Sisterhood's orders. Basmali's searchers found one such OP dominating a ridge above the no-globe site. It spread its leaves over almost 3 hectares. On the afternoon of the critical day, Basmali placed decoys at a distance from this position and opened a tunnel from a shallow swale into the Palingatam's roomy core. There he set up his command post and the backup necessities for escape.
"The tree is a life form," he explained to his people. "It will mask us from traces."
The unexpected. Nowhere in his planning did Basmali assume that all of his actions would go undetected. He could only spread his vulnerability. When the attack came, he saw that it appeared to follow a predicted pattern. He had anticipated that attackers would rely on no ships and great numbers as they had in the assault on the Gamu Keep. The Sisterhood's analysts assured him that the major threat was from forces out of the scattering, descendants of the Tleilaxu deployed by wildly brutal women calling themselves Honored Matres. He saw this as overconfidence and not audacity. A real audacity was in the arsenal of every student taught by the Bashar Miles Teg. It also helped that Teg could be relied upon to improvise within the limits of a plan. Through his relays, Basmali followed the scrambling escape of Duncan and Lucilla. Troopers with comm helmets and night lenses created a great display of activity at the decoy positions, while Basmali and his select reserves kept watch on the attackers, never betraying their position. Teg's movements were easily followed by his violent response to the attackers. Basmali noted with approval that Lucilla did not pause when she heard the battle sounds intensify. Duncan, however, tried to stop and almost ruined the plan. Lucilla saved the moment by jabbing Duncan in a sensitive nerve and barking, "You can't help him!" Hearing her voice clearly through his helmet amplifiers, Basmali cursed under his breath. Others would hear her too. No doubt they already were tracking her, though. Basmali issued a sub-vocal command through the microphone implanted in his neck and prepared to abandon his post. He kept most of his attention on the approach of Lucilla and Duncan. If all went as planned, his people would bring down the pair of them while 2 helmetless and suitably garbed troopers continued the flight toward the decoy positions. In the interim, Teg was creating an admirable path of destruction through which a ground car might escape. An aide intruded on Basmali.
"Two attackers are closing in behind the Basha."
Basmali waved the man aside. He could give little thought to Teg's chances. Everything had to be focused on saving the Gola. Basmali's thoughts were intense as he watched.
"Come on, run, run, damn you."
Lucilla held a similar thought as she urged Duncan forward, keeping herself close behind him to shield him from the rear. Everything about her was marshalled for ultimate resistance. Everything in her breeding and training came to the fore in these moments.
Never give up.
To give up was to pass her consciousness into the memory lives of a sister, or into oblivion. Even Shuang Yu had redeemed herself in the end by reverting to total resistance and had died admirably in the Bene Gesserit tradition, resisting to the last. Basmali had reported it through Teg. Lucilla, assembling her uncounted lives, thought,
"I can do no less."
She followed Duncan down into a shallow swale beside the hole of a giant Palingatam, and when people arose out of the darkness to drag them down, she almost responded in berserker mode, but a voice speaking Jacobsa in her ear said,
"Friends."
This delayed her response for a heartbeat while she saw the decoys continue the flight out of the swale. That, more than anything else, revealed the plan and the identity of the people holding them against the rich, leafy smells of the earth. When the people slid Duncan ahead of her into a tunnel aimed at the giant tree and, still in Chakobsa, cautioned speed, Lucilla knew she was caught in a typical Teg-style audacity. Duncan saw it too. At the Stygian outlet of the tunnel, he identified her by smell and tapped out a message against her arm in the old Atreides silent battle language.
"Let them lead."
The form of the message startled her momentarily, until she realized that the Gola, of course, would know this communication method. Without speaking, the people around them removed Duncan's bulky, antique lasgun and hustled the fugitives into the hatch of a vehicle that she did not identify. A brief red light flared in the darkness. Basmali spoke subvocally to his people.
There they go.
28 ground cars and 11 flitter-thopters scrambled from the decoy positions.
A proper diversion, Basmali thought.
Pressure in Lucilla's ears told her a hatch had been sealed. Again the red light flared and went dark. Explosives shattered the great tree around them, and their vehicle, now identifiable as an armoured ground car, surged up and out on suspensors and jets. Lucilla could follow their course only by flashes of fire and the twisting patterns of stars visible through frames of oval plaz. The enclosing suspensor field made the motions eerie, sensed only by the eyes. They sat cradled in plasteel seats while their car rocketed downslope, directly across Teg's holdout position, shifting and darting in violent changes of direction. None of this wild motion transmitted itself to the flesh of the occupants. There were only the dancing blurs of trees and brush, some of them burning, and then the stars. They were hugging the tops of the forest wreckage left by Teg's laserguns. Only then did she dare to hope that they might win free. Abruptly, their vehicle trembled into slow flight. The visible stars, framed by the tiny ovals of plaz, tipped and were obscured by a dark obstruction. Gravity returned and there was dim light. Lucilla saw Basmali fling open a hatch on her left.
Out! He snapped. Not a second to spare!
Duncan ahead of her, Lucilla scrambled out of the hatch onto damp earth. Basmali thumped her back, grabbed Duncan's arm and hustled them away from the car.
Quick! This way!
They crashed through tall bushes onto a narrow paved roadway. Basmali, a hand on each of them now, rushed them across the road and pushed them flat in a ditch. He whipped a life shield blanket over them and lifted his head to look back in the direction from which they had come. Lucilla peered past him and saw starlight on a snowy slope. She felt Duncan stir beside her. Far up the slope, a speeding ground car, its jet pod modifications visible against the stars, lifted on a plume of red, climbing, climbing, climbing. Suddenly it darted off to the right.
Ours?
Duncan whispered.
Yes. How did it get up there without showing up? An abandoned aqueduct tunnel, Basmali whispered. The car was programmed to go on automatic.
He continued to stare at the distant red plume. Abruptly, a gigantic burst of blue light rolled outward from the faraway red tracery. The light was followed immediately by a dull thump.
Ah,
Basmali breathed. Duncan, his voice low, said,
They're supposed to think you overloaded your drive.
Basmali shot a startled look at the young face, ghostly grey in starlight.
Duncan Idaho was one of the finest pilots in Atreides' service, Lucilla said.
It was an esoteric bit of knowledge, and it served its purpose. Basmali saw immediately that he was not just guardian of two fugitives. His charges possessed abilities that could be used if needed. Blue and red sparks flashed across the sky where the modified ground car had exploded. The no-ships were sniffing that distant globe of hot gases. What would the sniffers decide? The blue and red sparks slipped down behind the starlit bulges of the hills. Basmali whirled at the sound of footsteps on the roadway. Duncan had a handgun out so swiftly that Lucilla gasped. She put a restraining hand on his arm, but he shook it off. Didn't he see that Basmali had accepted this intrusion? A voice called softly from the roadway above them.
Follow me! Hurry!
The speaker, a moving blot of darkness, jumped down beside them and went crashing through a gap in the bushes lining the road. Dark spots on a snowy slope beyond the screening bushes resolved themselves into at least a dozen armed figures. Five of this party grouped themselves around Duncan and Lucilla, and urged them silently along a snow-covered trail beside the bushes. The rest of the armed party ran openly down across the snow slope into a dark line of trees. Within 100 paces, the five silent figures formed their party into single file, two of their number ahead, three behind. The fugitives sheltered between them, with Basmali leading and Lucilla close behind Duncan. They came presently to a cleft in dark rocks and under a ledge where they waited, listening to more modified ground cars thunder into the air behind them.
Decoys upon decoys, Basmali whispered. We overload them with decoys. They know we must flee in panic as fast as possible. Now,
We will wait nearby in concealment. Later we will proceed slowly, on foot.
The unexpected, Lucilla whispered.
Teg?
It was Duncan, his voice little more than a breath. Rosmarie leaned close to Duncan's left ear.
I think they got him.
Bosmari's whisper carried a deep tone of sadness. One of their dark companions said,
Quickly now, down here.
They were herded through the narrow cleft. Something emitted a creaking sound nearby. Hands hustled them into an enclosed passage. The creaking sounded from behind them.
Get that door fixed,
someone said. Light flared around them. Duncan and Lucilla stared around a large, richly furnished room apparently cut into rock. Soft carpets covered the floor, dark reds and golds with a figured pattern like repetitive battlements worked in pale green. A bundle of clothing lay in a jumble on a table near Bosmarie, who was in low-voiced conversation with one of their escort, a fair-haired man with high forehead and piercing green eyes. Lucilla listened carefully. The words were understandable, relating how guards had been posted, but the green-eyed man's accent was one she had never before heard. A tumble of gutturals and consonants clicked off with surprising abruptness.
Is this a no-chamber? She asked.
No.
The answer was supplied by a man behind her speaking in that same accent.
The algae protect us.
She did not turn toward the speaker, but looked up instead at the light yellow-green algae thick on the ceiling and walls. Only a few patches of dark rock were visible near the floors. Bosmarie broke off his conversation.
We are safe here. The algae is grown especially for this. Life scanners report only the presence of plant life and nothing else that the algae shields.
Lucilla pivoted on one heel, sorting the room's details. That Harkonnen griffin worked into a crystal table, the exotic fabrics on chairs and couches. A weapons rack against one wall held two rows of long, field-style laser guns of a design she had never before seen. Each was bell-mouthed and with a curling gold guard over the trigger. Bosmarie had returned to his conversation with the green-eyed man. It was an argument over how they would be disguised. She listened with part of her mind while she studied the two members of their escort remaining in the room. The other three from the escort had filed out through a passage near the weapons cabinet, an opening covered by a thick hanging of shimmering silvery threads. Duncan, she saw, was watching her responses with care, his hand on the small laser gun in his belt.
People of the scattering? Lucilla wondered. What are their loyalties?
Casually, she crossed to Duncan's side and, using the finger-touch language on his arm, relayed her suspicions. Both of them looked at Bosmarie.
Treachery?
Lucilla went back to her study of the room. Were they being watched by unseen eyes? Nine glow-globes lighted the space, creating their own peculiar islands of intense illumination. It reached outward into a common concentration near where Bosmarie still talked to the green-eyed man. Part of the light came directly from the drifting globes, all of them tuned into rich gold, and part of it was reflected more softly off the algae. The result was a lack of dark shadows, even under the furnishings. The shimmering silver threads of the inner doorway parted. An old woman entered the room. Lucilla stared at her. The woman had a seamed face as dark as old rosewood. Her features were sharply defined in a narrow frame of straggling grey hair that fell almost to her shoulders. She wore a long black robe, worked with golden threads in a pattern of mythological dragons. The woman stopped behind a settee and placed her deeply veined hands on the back. Bosmarie and his companion broke off their conversation. Lucilla looked from the old woman down to her own robe. Except for the golden dragons, the garments were similar in design, the hoods draped back onto the shoulders. Only in the side cut and the way it opened down the front was the design of the dragon robe different. When the woman did not speak, Lucilla looked to Bosmarie for explanation. Bosmarie stared back at her with a look of intense concentration. The old woman continued to study Lucilla silently. The intensity of attention filled Lucilla with disquiet. Duncan felt it too, she saw. He kept his hand on the small laser gun. The long silence while eyes examined her amplified her unease. There was something almost Bene Gesserit about the way the old woman just stood there, looking. Duncan broke the silence.
demanding of Burzmali.
Who is she?
I'm the one who'll save your skins, the old woman said. She had a thin voice that crackled weakly, but that same strange accent.
Lucilla's other memories brought up a suggestive comparison for the old woman's garment, similar to that worn by ancient playfems. Lucilla almost shook her head. Surely this woman was too old for such a role, and the shape of the mythic dragons worked into the fabric differed from those supplied by memory. Lucilla returned her attention to the old face, eyes humid with the illnesses of age. A dry crust had settled into the creases where each eyelid touched the channels beside her nose, far too old for a play femme. The old woman spoke to Burzmali.
I think she can wear it well enough.
She began divesting herself of her dragon robe. To Lucilla she said,
This is for you. Wear it with respect. We killed to get it for you.
Who did you kill?
Lucilla demanded.
A postulant of the honored Matres.
There was a pride in the old woman's husky tone.
Why should I wear that robe? Lucilla demanded.
You will trade garments with me, the old woman said.
Not without explanation.
Lucilla refused to accept the robe being extended to her. Burzmali took one step forward.
You can trust her.
I am a friend of your friends, the old woman said.
She shook the robe in front of Lucilla.
Here, take it.
Lucilla addressed Burzmali.
I must know your plan.
We both must know it,
Duncan said.
On whose authority are we asked to trust these people?
Teg's,
Burzmali said.
And mine.
He looked at the old woman.
You can tell them, Serapha. We have time.
You will wear this robe while you accompany Burzmali into Yasai,
Serapha said. Serapha, Lucilla thought. The name had almost the sound of the Bene Gesserit lineal variant. Serapha studied Duncan.
Yes, he is small enough yet. He will be disguised and conveyed separately.
No,
Lucilla said. I am commanded to guard him.
You are being foolish, Serapha said. They will be looking for a woman of your appearance accompanied by someone of this young man's appearance. They will not be looking for a playfemme of the honored Matres with her companion of the night, nor for a Tlelaxu master and his entourage.
Lucilla wet her lips with her tongue. Serapha spoke with the confident assurance of a house proctor. Serapha draped the dragon robe over the back of the settee. She stood revealed in a clinging black leotard that concealed nothing of a body still lithe and supple, even well-rounded. The body looked much younger than the face. As Lucilla looked at her, Serapha passed her palms across her forehead and cheeks, smoothing them backward. Age lines grew shallow, and a younger face was revealed.
A face dancer?
Lucilla stared hard at the woman. There were none of the other face dancer stigmata. Still.
Get your robe off,
Serapha ordered. Now her voice was younger and even more commanding.
You must do it, Burzmali pleaded. Serapha will take your place as another decoy. It's the only way we'll get through.
Get through to what?
Duncan said.
To a no-ship, Burzmali said.
And where will that take us?
Lucilla demanded.
To safety, Burzmali said. We will be loaded with Shear, but I cannot say more. Even Shear wears off in time.
How will I be disguised as a Tlelaxu?
Duncan asked.
Trust us that it will be done, Burzmali said.
He kept his attention on Lucilla.
Reverend Mother?
You give me no choice, Lucilla said.
She undid the quick fasteners and dropped her robe. She removed the small handgun from her bodice and tossed it onto the settee. Her own leotard was light grey, and she saw Serapha making note of this, and of the knives in their leg sheaths.
We sometimes wear black undergarments,
Lucilla said, as she slipped into the dragon robe. The fabric looked heavy but felt light. She pivoted in it, sensing the way it flared and fitted itself to her body almost as though it had been made just for her. There was a rough spot at the neck. She reached up and ran a finger along it.
That is where the dart struck her, Serapha said. We moved fast, but the acid scarred the fabric slightly. yet is not visible to the eye.
Is the appearance correct?
Busmali asked Serapha.
Very good. But I will have to instruct her. She must make no mistakes, or they will have both of you like that.
Serapha clapped her hands for emphasis.
Where have I seen that gesture?
Lucilla asked herself. Duncan touched the back of Lucilla's right arm, his fingers secretly quick talking. That hand clap, a mannerism of Gidi Prime. Other memories confirmed this for Lucilla. Was this woman part of an isolated community, preserving archaic ways?
The lad should go now,
Serapha said. She gestured to the two remaining members of the escort.
Take him to the place.
I don't like this, Lucilla said.
We have no choice, Busmali barked.
Lucilla could only agree. She was relying on Busmali's oath of loyalty to the sisterhood, she knew. And Duncan was not a child, she reminded herself. His Prana Bindu reactions had been conditioned by the old Bashar and herself. There were abilities in the Gola that few people outside of the Bene Gesserit could match. She watched silently as Duncan and the two men left through the shimmering curtain. When they were gone, Serapha came around the settee and stood in front of Lucilla, hands on hips. Their gazes met at a level. Busmali cleared his throat and fingered the rough pile of clothing on the table beside him. Serapha's face, especially the eyes, held a remarkably compelling quality. The eyes were light green, with clear whites. No lens or other artifice masked them.
You have the right look about you, Serapha said. Remember that you are a special kind of playfem, and Busmali is your customer. No ordinary person would interfere with that.
Lucilla heard a veiled hint in this.
But there are those who might interfere?
Embassies from great religions are on Gamu now, Serapha said. Some you have never encountered. They are from what you call the scattering.
And what do you call it?
The Seeking.
Serapha raised a placating hand.
Do not fear. We have a common enemy.
The honored Matres?
Serapha turned her head to the left and spat on the floor.
Look at me, Bene Gesserit. I was trained only to kill them. That is my only function and purpose.
Lucilla spoke carefully.
From what we know, you must be very good.
In some things, perhaps I am better than you. Now listen. You are a sexual adept. Do you understand?
Why would priests interfere?
You call them priests? Well, yes, they would not interfere for any reason you might imagine. Sex for pleasure, the enemy of religion, eh?
Accept no substitutes for holy joy, Lucilla said.
Tantrus protect you, woman. There are different priests from the Seeking. Ones who do not mind offering immediate ecstasy instead of a promised hereafter.
Lucilla almost smiled. Did this self-styled killer of honored matres think she could advise a reverend mother on religions?
There are people here who go about disguised as priests, Serapha said. Very dangerous. The most dangerous of all are those who follow Tantrus and claim that sex is the exclusive worship of their god.
How will I know them?
Lucilla heard sincerity in Serapha's voice and a sense of foreboding.
That is not a concern. You must never act as though you recognize such distinctions. Your first concern is to make sure of your pay. You, I think, should ask 50 solari.
You have not told me why they would interfere.
Lucilla glanced back at Busmali. He had laid out the rough clothing and was taking off his battle fatigues. She returned her attention to Serapha.
Some follow an ancient convention that grants them the right to disrupt your arrangement with Busmali. In actuality, some will be testing you.
Listen carefully, Busmali said. This is important.
Serapha said,
Busmali will be dressed as a field worker. Nothing else could disguise his weapons' calluses. You will address him as Scar, a common name here.
But how do I deal with a priest's interruption?
Serapha produced a small pouch from her bodice and passed it to Lucilla, who hefted it in one hand.
That contains 283 solari. If someone identifying himself as a divine, you remember that, divine?
How could I forget it? Lucilla's voice was almost a sneer, but Serapha paid no heed.
If such a one interferes, you will return 50 solari to Burzmali with your regrets. Also, in that pouch is your playfem card in the name of Pyrrha. Let me hear you say your name.
Pyrrha.
No, accent much harder on the A.
Pyrrha.
That is possible. Now, listen to me with extreme care. You and Burzmali will be on the streets late. It will be expected that you have had previous customers. There must be evidence. Therefore, you will, entertain Burzmali before leaving here. You understand?
Such delicacy, Lucilla said.
Serapha took it as a compliment and smiled, but it was a tightly controlled expression.
Her reactions were so alien.
One thing, Lucilla said. If I must entertain a divine, how will I find Burzmali afterward?
Scar.
Yes.
How will I find Scar?
He will wait nearby wherever you go. Scar will find you when you emerge.
Very well. If a divine interrupts, I return 100 solari to Scar and
50.
I think not, Serapha.
Lucilla shook her head slowly from side to side.
After being entertained by me, the divine will know that 50 solari is too small a sum.
Serapha pursed her lips and glanced past Lucilla at Burzmali.
You warned me about her kind, but I did not suppose that,
using only a touch of voice, Lucilla said,
you suppose nothing unless you hear it from me.
Serapha scowled. She was obviously startled by voice, but her tone was just as arrogant when she resumed.
Do I presume that you need no explanation of sexual variations?
A safe assumption, Lucilla said.
And I do not need to tell you that your robe identifies you as a fifth stage adept in the Order of Hormu.
It was Lucilla's turn to scowl.
What if I show abilities beyond this fifth stage?
Ah, Serapha said. You will continue to heed my words, then?
Lucilla nodded curtly.
Very good, Serapha said. May I presume you can administer vaginal pulsing?
I can.
From any position?
I can control any muscle in my body.
Serapha glanced past Lucilla at Burzmali.
True?
Burzmali spoke from close behind Lucilla.
Or she would not claim it.
Serapha looked thoughtful, her focus on Lucilla's chin.
This is a complication, I think.
Lest you get the wrong idea, Lucilla said, the abilities I was taught are not usually marketed. They have another purpose.
Oh, I'm sure they do, Serapha said. But sexual agility is a...
agility?
Lucilla allowed her tone to convey the full weight of a reverend mother's outrage. No matter that this might be what Serapha hoped to achieve, she had to be put in her place.
Agility, you say? I can control genital temperature. I know I can arouse the 51 excitation points.
51? But there are only
51,
Lucilla snapped. And the sequencing plus the combinations number 2008. Furthermore, in combination with the 205 sexual positions...
205?
Serapha was clearly startled.
Surely you don't mean...
More, actually, if you count minor variations. I am an imprinter, which means I have mastered the 300 steps of orgasmic amplification.
Serapha cleared her throat and wet her lips with her tongue.
I must warn you then to restrain yourself. Keep your full abilities unexpressed, or...
Once more she looked at Burzmali.
Why didn't you warn me?
I did.
Lucilla clearly heard amusement in his voice, but did not look back to confirm it. Serapha inhaled and expelled two hard breaths.
If any questions are asked, you will say you are about to undergo testing for advancement. That may quiet suspicion.
And if I'm asked about the test?
Oh, that is easy. You smile mysteriously and remain silent.
What if I'm asked about this Order of Hormu?
Threaten to report the questioner to your superiors.
The questions should stop.
And if they don't? Serapha shrugged.
Make up any story you like. Even a truth-sayer would be amused by your evasions.
Lucilla held her face in repose while she thought about her situation. She heard Buzmali, Scar, stirring directly behind her. She saw no serious difficulties in carrying out this deception. It might even provide an amusing interlude she could recount later at Chapter House. Serapha, she noted, was grinning at Buzz... Scar. Lucilla turned and looked at her customer. Buzmali stood there naked, his battle garb and helmet neatly stacked beside the small mound of rough clothing.
I can see that Scar does not object to your preparations for this venture, Serapha said.
She waved a hand at his stiffly upcocked penis.
I will leave you then.
Lucilla heard Serapha depart through the shimmering curtain. Filling Lucilla's thoughts was an angry realization.
This should be the Gola here now.
It is your fate, forgetfulness. All of the old lessons of life. You lose and gain, and lose and gain again.
Later the second. The voice of Darius Balat.
In the name of our order and its unbroken sisterhood, this account has been judged reliable and worthy of entry into the Chronicles of Chapter House.
Terraza stared at the words on her display projection with an expression of distaste. Morning light painted a fuzz of yellow reflections in the projection, making the words there appear dimly mysterious. With an angry motion, Terraza pushed herself back from the projection table, arose and went to a south window. The day was young yet, and the shadows long in her courtyard.
Shall I go in person?
Reluctance filled her at this thought. These quarters felt so secure. But that was foolishness, and she knew it in every fibre. The Bene Gesserit had been here more than 1,400 years, and still Chapter House Planet must be considered only temporary. She rested her left hand on the smooth frame of the window. Each of her windows had been positioned to focus the attention on a splendid view. The room, its proportions, furnishing, colours, all reflected architects and builders who had worked single-mindedly to create a sense of support for the occupants. Terraza tried to immerse herself in that supportive feeling and failed. The arguments she had just experienced left a bitterness in this room, even though the words had been voiced in the mildest tones. Her counsellors had been stubborn and, she agreed without reservation, for understandable reasons.
Make ourselves into missionaries? And for the Tleilaxu?
She touched a control plate beside the window and opened it. A warm breeze perfumed by spring blossoms from the apple orchards wafted into the room. The sisterhood was proud of the fruit they grew here at the power center of all their strongholds. No finer orchards existed at any of the keeps and dependent chapters that wove the Bene Gesserit web through most of the planets humans had occupied under the old Imperium.
By their fruits ye shall know them, she thought. Some of the old religions can still produce wisdom.
From her high vantage, Terraza could see the entire southern sprawl of Chapter House buildings. The shadow of a nearby watchtower drew a long, uneven line across rooftops and courtyards. When she thought about it, she knew this was a surprisingly small establishment to contain so much power. Beyond the ring of orchards and gardens lay a careful checkerboard of private residences, each with its surrounding plantation. Retired sisters and selected loyal families occupied these privileged estates. Saw-toothed mountains, their tops often brilliant with snow, drew the western limits. The space field lay 20 kilometres eastward. All around this core of Chapter House were open plains where grazed a peculiar breed of cattle, a cattle so susceptible to alien odours they would stampede in raucous bellowing at the slightest intrusion of people not marked by the local smell. The innermost homes, with their pane-fenced plantings, had been sited by an early bashar in such a way that no one could move through the twisting ground-level channels day or night without being observed. It all appeared so haphazard and casual, yet there was harsh order in it, and that, Terraza knew, personified the sisterhood. The clearing of a throat behind her reminded Terraza that one of those who had argued most vehemently in council remained waiting patiently in the open doorway.
Waiting for my decision.
The Reverend Mother Belonda wanted Odraid
killed out of hand. No decision had been reached.
You've really done it this time, Dar. I expected your wild independence. I even wanted it. But this...
Belonda, old, fat, and florid, cold-eyed and valued for her natural viciousness, wanted Odraid condemned as a traitor.
The tyrant would have crushed her immediately, Belonda argued.
Is that all we learned from him? Terrazza wondered.
Belonda argued that Odraid was not only an Atreides, but also a Corino. There were emperors and vice-regents and powerful administrators to a very large number in her ancestry.
With all of the power hunger this implies.
Her ancestors survived Seleucus Secundus, Belonda kept repeating. Have we learned nothing from our breeding experiences?
We learned how to create Odraids, Terrazza thought.
After surviving the spice agony, Odraid had been sent to Aldanab, an equivalent of Seleucus Secundus, there to be conditioned deliberately on a planet of constant testing. High cliffs and dry gorges, hot winds and frigid winds, little moisture and too much. It was judged a suitable proving ground for someone whose destiny might take her to Rakus. Tough survivors emerged from such conditioning. The tall, supple and muscular Odraid was one of the toughest.
How can I salvage this situation?
Odraid's most recent message said that any peace, even the tyrant's millennia of suppression, radiated a false aura that could be fatal to those who trusted it too much. That was both the strength and flaw in Belonda's argument. Terrazza lifted her gaze to Belonda waiting in the doorway.
She is too fat. She flaunts that before us.
We can no more eliminate Odraid than we can eliminate the Gola, Terrazza said.
Belonda's voice came low and level.
Both are now too dangerous to us. Look how Odraid weakens you with her account of those words at Siech Tabor.
Has the tyrant's message weakened me, Bell?
You know what I mean. The Benetleylax have no morals.
Quit changing the subject, Bell. Your thoughts are darting around like an insect among the blossoms. What is it you really smell here?
The Tleylaxu. They made that gola for their own purposes, and now Odraid wants us to...
You're repeating yourself, Bell.
The Tleylaxu take shortcuts. Their view of genetics is not our view. It is not a human view. They make monsters.
Is that what they do?
Belonda came into the room, walking around the table, and stood close to Terrazza, blocking the Mother Superior's view of the niche and its statuette of Chenoa.
Alliance with a priest of Rakis, yes, but not with the Tleylaxu.
Belonda's robes rustled as she gestured with a clenched fist.
Bell, the High Priest is now a mimic face dancer. Ally with him, you mean?
Belonda shook her head angrily.
Believers in Shai Hulud are legion. You find them everywhere. What will be their reaction to us if our part in the deception is ever exposed?
No, you don't, Bell.
We have seen to it that only the Tleylaxu are vulnerable here. In that, Odraid's right. Wrong! If we ally with them, we are both vulnerable. We will be forced to serve the Tleylaxu design. It will be worse than our long subservience to the tyrant.
Terrazza saw the vicious glinting of Belonda's eyes. Her reaction was understandable. No reverend mother could contemplate the special bondage they had endured under the God Emperor without at least some chilling remembrances. Whipped along against their will, never sure of Bene Gesserit's survival from one day to the next.
You think we assure our spice supply by such a stupid alliance? Belonda demanded.
It was the same old argument, Terrazza saw. Without Melange and the agony of its transformation, there could be no reverend mothers. The whores of the scattering surely had Melange as one of their targets, the spice and the Bene Gesserit mastery of it. Terrazza returned to her table and sank into her chair dog, leaning back while it moulded itself to her contours. It was a problem, a peculiar Bene Gesserit problem. Although they searched and experimented constantly, the sisterhood had never found a substitute for the spice. The Spacing Guild might want Melange to transform its navigators, but they could substitute Ixian machinery. Ix and its subsidiaries competed in the Guild's markets. They had alternatives.
We have none.
Belonda crossed to the other side of Terrazza's table, put both fists on the smooth surface, and leaned forward to look down at the Mother Superior.
And we still don't know what the Tleylaxu did to our Gola.
Odraid will find out.
Not reason enough to forgive her treachery.
Terrazza spoke in a low voice.
We waited for this moment, through generation after generation, and you would abort the project just like that.
She slapped a palm lightly against the table.
The precious Rakian project is no longer our project,
Melonda said.
It may never have been.
All of her considerable mental powers in hard focus, Terraza re-examined the implications of this familiar argument. It was a thing spoken frequently in the wrangling session they had concluded earlier. Was the Gola scheme something set in motion by the tyrant? If so, what could they do about it now? What should they do about it? During the long dispute, the minority report had been in all of their minds. Shuangyu might be dead, but her faction survived, and it looked now as though Belonda had joined them. Was the sisterhood blinding itself to a fatal possibility? Odraid's report of that hidden message on Rakis could be interpreted as an ominous warning. Odraid emphasized this by reporting how she had been alerted by her inner sense of alarm. No reverend mother could treat such an event lightly. Belonda straightened and folded her arms across her breast.
We never completely escape the teachers of our childhood, nor any of the patterns that formed us, do we?
That was an argument peculiar to Bene Gesserit disputes. It reminded them of their own particular susceptibility.
We are the secret aristocrats, and it is our offspring who inherit the power. Yes, we are susceptible to that, and Miles Tegg is a superb example.
Melonda found a straight chair and sat down, bringing her eyes level with Terraza's.
At the height of the scattering, she said, we lost some 20% of our failures. It is not failures who are coming back to us, but the tyrant surely knew this would happen. The scattering was his goal, Bell. That was his golden path, humankind's survival. But we know how he felt about the Tleilaxu, and yet he did not exterminate them. He could have, and he did not. He wanted diversity.
Belonda pounded a fist on the table.
He certainly got that. We've been through all of these arguments over and over, Bell, and I still see no way to escape what Odraid has done. Subservience! Not at all. Were we ever totally subservient to one of the pre-tyrant emperors? Not even to Muad'Dib. We are still in the tyrant's trap, Belonda accused. Tell me, why have the Tleilaxu continued to produce his favorite Gola? Millennia, and still that Gola keeps coming out of their tanks like a dancing doll. You think the Tleilaxu still follow a secret order from the tyrant? If so, then you argue for Odraid. She has created admirable conditions for us to examine this. He ordered nothing of the kind. He merely made that particular Gola deliciously attractive to the Bene Tleilax, and not to us. Mother Superior, we must get ourselves out of the tyrant's trap now, and by the most direct method. The decision is mine, Bell. I still lean toward a cautious alliance. Then at the very least let us kill the Gola. Shiana can have children. We could— This is not now, and never was, purely a breeding project. But it could be. What if you're wrong about the power behind the Atreides' prescience? All of your proposals lead to alienation from Rakis and from the Tleilaxu, Bell. The sisterhood could weather 15 generations on our present stockpiles of melange, more with rationing. You think 50 generations is a long time, Bell? Don't you see that this very attitude is why you are not sitting in my chair?
Belonda pushed herself back from the table, her chair scraping harshly against the floor. Terraza could see that she was not convinced. Belonda no longer could be trusted. She might be the one who would have to die. And where was the noble purpose in that?
This gets us nowhere, Terraza said. Leave me.
When she was alone, Terraza once more considered Odraid's message. Ominous. It was easy to see why Belonda and others reacted violently. But that showed a dangerous lack of control.
It is not yet time to write the sisterhood's final will and testament.
In an odd way, Odraid and Belonda shared the same fear, but came to different decisions because of that fear. Odraid's interpretation of that message in the Stones of Rakis conveyed an old warning.
This too shall pass away. Are we to end now, crushed by ravenous hordes from the scattering?
But the secret of the axolotl tanks was almost within the sisterhood's grasp.
If we gain that, nothing can stop us.
Terraza swung her gaze around the details of her room. The Bene Gesserit power was still here. Chapter House remained concealed behind a moat of no-ships, its location unrecorded except in the minds of her own people. Invisibility. Temporary invisibility. Accidents occurred. Terrazza squared her shoulders. Take precautions, but don't live in their shadows, constantly furtive. The litany against fear served a useful purpose when avoiding shadows. From anyone but Adraid, the warning message with its disturbing implications that the tyrant still guided his golden path would have been far less fearsome. That damnable Atreides talent. No more than a secret society? Terrazza gritted her teeth in frustration. Memories are not enough unless they call you to noble purpose. And what if it was true that the Sisterhood no longer heard the music of life? Damn him! The tyrant could still touch them. What is he trying to tell us? His golden path could not be in peril. The scattering had seen to that. Humans had spread their kind outward on uncounted courses like the spines of a hedgehog. Had he seen a vision of the scattered ones returning? Could he possibly have anticipated this bramble patch at the foot of his golden path? He knew we would suspect his powers. He knew it. Terrazza thought about the mounting reports of the lost ones who were returning to their roots. A remarkable diversity of people and artifacts, accompanied by a remarkable degree of secrecy and wide evidence of conspiracy. No ships of a peculiar design, weapons and artifacts of breathtaking sophistication, diverse peoples and diverse ways. Some astonishingly primitive, at least on the surface. And they wanted much more than melange. Terrazza recognized the peculiar form of mysticism that drove the scattered ones back. We want your elder secrets. The message of the honored Matres was clear enough, too. We will take what we want. Odraid has it all right in her hands, Terrazza thought. She had Shiana. Soon, if Bersmali succeeded, she would have the Gola. She had the Thlelaxo Master of Masters. She could have Rakis itself. If only she were not an Atreides. Terrazza glanced at the projected words still dancing above her tabletop. A comparison of this newest Duncan Idaho with all of the slain ones. Each new Gola had been slightly different from its predecessors, that was clear enough. The Thlelaxu were perfecting something. But what? Was the clue hidden in these new face dancers? The Thlelaxu obviously sought an undetectable face dancer, mimics whose mimicry reached perfection, shape copiers who copied not only the surface memories of their victims, but the deepest thoughts and identity as well. It was a form of immortality even more enticing than the one the Thlelaxu masters used at present. That obviously was why they followed this course. Her own analysis agreed with the majority of her advice.